had any ideas about her replacement. Sure, right here in NR. She's pulled together a crack team of young officers who love her. She's a leader. Donna. Well, of course. She would be great. Why didn't I think of her? I knew the reason. She was not an operations officer. She was a reports officer. I served a bias, like other operations officers, and it was a fault. Donna had had multiple tours abroad. She knew the division as well as anybody, and she understood the substantive issues better than anybody. Her collection initiatives had helped the division more than double intelligence production in a year. With her help, the division had also boosted its recruitment to foreign agents. She could lead, and not just those under her direct command. She could build and lead effective networks across the agency, across the intelligence community. Best of all, she would not tolerate any bullshit, including mine. I had seen her rip the bark off a few arrogant, macho case officers who had challenged her. I stuck my head out the door and asked my secretary to get Donna. She arrived in a few seconds, pad and pen in hand, and plopped down on the couch. Gina was behind her desk.
"Well, what do you want?"
Donna asked, wondering about our silence and grins.
"Hank has decided on his new deputy," Gina said.
"Oh, good. Who?"
"You," I answered. Donna gasped, then blinked rapidly.
"You have to be kidding,"
Donna finally responded. "Nope," I said.
"You are the best. You, in fact, are the only candidate," Gina added.
"Gina, you can start her in brief," I instructed as I walked out the door, leaving them to sort out the transition. That was one of the best management decisions that I ever made. Donna would serve as deputy chief of NR for a couple of years and would be promoted into the senior intelligence service. She eventually moved to another job, in charge of all resource management for the clandestine service. Although she had joined the agency as a GS-5, she would retire as an SIS-5. In military terms, she had gone from a raw grunt to a 4-star general during her 25 years of service. More important, she had helped advance critical intelligence collection and resource management in the post-9/11 era. With a good deputy in place, I could get back on the road. I spent about half my time traveling in the United States, seeking to learn and to lead from the field, helping NR stations advance their relationships and their mission. Our aggressive intelligence push throughout the homeland worried and irritated some FBI officials, who saw NR's success as their failure. A couple of great FBI partners retired in disgust at this attempt to discredit our collective efforts. Others advocated a reduced role for NR, and this included FBI pleas to White House officials. At one point, I provided Fran Townsend, the president's Homeland Security advisor, a comparison of NR and FBI reporting on counterterrorism. It was an embarrassment for the FBI, and only angered the Bureau more. As chief of NR, I fretted about our borders. Obviously, AQ, Hezbollah, Hamas, and others had infiltrated into our homeland. As the U.S. government poured resources into better screening at ports of entry, the enemy would seek other means of access. I figured they would infiltrate overland in desolate areas seldom monitored or patrolled. I was not concerned that much with illegal immigration, understanding that almost all illegal immigrants come to the United States searching for work. If we want to stop them, why not sanction those employers who hire them? From first-hand experience, even outside my clandestine operations, I knew how porous borders could be. Years earlier, on a backpacking trip with my dad in Big Bend National Park in Texas, we had worked our way down to the Rio Grande. This was after 3 days sleeping on rocky ground up high in the Chisos Mountains. It was winter and we were cold, and my dad was tired of eating my camp stove cooking. "We gotta get a decent lunch, son," he said.
Papa, there's nothing here, not on this side of the river, I explained, as we walked along the riverbank. It was almost noon, and the warm sun at this low elevation felt great.
Nothing? He asked again.
Looking at the map, I spotted a village in Mexico, less than a mile away.
We could try this Mexican village, but I'm not sure how we cross the river.
We walked another few hundred yards and spotted a guy with a small boat.
I approached him.
How much?
$1 to cross and $2 to come back to Estados Unidos, he answered.
Deal, I said. We proceeded into Mexico. After a great lunch of Mexican tacos, we strolled back to the river and our canoe captain poled us back to the United States. I never reported that foreign trip to the CIA. As chief of NR, I did share the story with some U.S. Customs and Border Patrol agents on the U.S.-Canadian border while visiting with them. It was the dead cold of winter in Maine, and I was there meeting these law enforcement agents to gain a better understanding of intelligence in border operations. We were swapping stories about cross-border incursions. I had breached many borders in my professional capacity, using a variety of documents and means of travel, but they laughed the most about my incursion into Mexico with my dad. I had never seen anything like what the Border Patrol showed me along the Canadian border. We mounted high-speed snowmobiles and zipped to the border crossing, where we met a Royal Canadian Mounted Police, RCMP, patrol, also on snowmobiles. We then embarked on a joint patrol, a face-numbing journey along the heavily wooded, deeply snow-packed international boundary. We stopped periodically to examine the tracks of other snowmobiles, some towing sleds, that had crossed the previous evening. This was the spoor of smugglers. They were hauling goods and people from Canada to the United States. The scope of their illicit traffic, marked in the fresh snow, shocked me.
How do they go undetected? I asked.
Oh, we catch some, but it's a question of basic math. There are so many of them, so few of us, and a huge, wide-open border, the lead agent explained. He pulled out a map to show how far we had covered. The distance of several miles was a tiny fraction of their vast area of operation.
Let's go back and we'll give you another perspective, he offered.
In a small Cessna aircraft, we swooped along the border. The fresh snowfall offered a dramatic canvas for the etched crisscross tracks of smugglers and law enforcement officers. Later, sipping hot tea in the tiny office next to the hangar, I inquired about their intelligence collection capabilities besides ground and air patrol. IMINT, SIGINT, HUMINT? They shook their heads.
Although locals will sometimes report suspicious activity, they explained, there is little else except our own recon.
What do you get from Washington, D.C. in terms of useful intelligence? I asked. They all laughed.
Nothing.
What about our Canadian allies?
Oh, they have the same problem that we do, but even less budget and less capability, they answered.
I left with a forest green, stainless steel U.S. Border Patrol mug and a new appreciation for the scope of the challenge. Chapter 14. Policy. The first, the supreme, the most far-reaching act of judgment that the statesman and commander have to make is to establish by that test the kind of war on which they are embarking, neither mistaking it for, nor trying to turn it into, something that is alien to its nature. This is the first of all strategic questions, and the most comprehensive. Carl von Clausewitz, On War. Translation Michael Howard and Peter Perret. In February 2005, the new counselor at the Department of State, Philip Zelikow, asked me to visit. We had met 2 years earlier when he was the executive director of the 9/11 Commission. He and others had interviewed me for the Commission's report, which noted my advocacy for U.S. intervention against AQ in Afghanistan prior to 9/11. The commission released its report in July 2004. The first half of the commission's text, for which Zelikow and his staff were responsible, captured the historical events in a clear and compelling manner. The second half of the report, which dealt with the commissioner's recommendations, was both sensible and silly. Of course, Congress should retool its oversight of the intelligence community. Of course, there should be greater integration of the intelligence. But why establish another layer of bureaucracy with a director of national intelligence? Why give the FBI a free pass after its mistakes? Why undercut the CIA when, according to the report itself, the CIA understood the AQ threat and did far more about it than any other government agency? Why recommend that the CIA's paramilitary arm, a critical and leading ingredient in the whip-ass recipe of 2001-2002, be disbanded? Moreover, why had the commission looked only at the